Chapter 4. The parish, don't you? Apostrophe, apostrophe, yes, sir, apostrophe, replied Oliver, weeping bitterly. What are you crying for? Apostrophe, apostrophe, inquired the gentleman in the white waistcoat. And to be sure it was very extraordinary. What could the boy be crying for? I hope you say your prayers every night, apostrophe, said another gentleman in a gruff voice. And pray for the people who feed you, and take care of you like a Christian. Apostrophe, yes, sir, apostrophe, stammered the boy. The gentleman who spoke last was unconsciously right. It would have been very like a Christian, and a marvelously good Christian too, if Oliver had prayed for the people who fed and took care of him. But he hadn't, because nobody had taught him. Well, you have come here to be educated, and taught a useful trade, apostrophe said the red-faced gentleman in the high chair. So you'll begin to pick oakum, tomorrow morning at 6 o'clock, apostrophe added the surly one in the white waistcoat. For the combination of both these blessings in the one simple process of picking oakum, Oliver bowed low by the direction of the beadle, and was then hurried away to a large ward, where, on a rough, hard bed, he sobbed himself to sleep. What a novel illustration of the tender laws of England! They let the paupers go to sleep. Poor Oliver! He little thought, as he lay sleeping in happy unconsciousness of all around him, that the board had that very day arrived at a decision which would exercise the most material influence over all his future fortunes. But they had. And this was it. The members of this board were very sage, deep, philosophical men, and when they came to turn their attention to the workhouse, they found out at once, what ordinary folks would never have discovered, the poor people liked it. It was a regular place of public entertainment for the poorer classes, a tavern where there was nothing to pay, a public breakfast, dinner, tea, and supper all the year round. A brick-and-mortar lyceum, where it was all play and no work. Oh, oh! Apostrophe said the board, looking very knowing. We are the fellows to set this to rights. We'll stop it all, in no time. Apostrophe so, they established the rule, that all poor people should have the alternative, for they would compel nobody, not they, of being starved by a gradual process in the house, or by a quick one out of it. With this view, they contracted with the waterworks to lay on an unlimited supply of water, and with a corn factor, to supply periodically small quantities of oatmeal, and issued 3 meals of thin gruel a day, with an onion twice a week, and half a roll of Sundays. They made a great many other wise and humane regulations, having reference to the ladies, which it is not necessary to repeat. Kindly undertook to divorce poor married people, in consequence of the great expense of a suit in Doctors' Commons, and, instead of compelling a man to support his family, as they had theretofore done, took his family away from him, and made him a bachelor. There is no saying how many applicants for relief, under these last two heads, might have started up in all classes of society, if it had not been coupled with the workhouse. But the board were long-headed men, and had provided for this difficulty. The relief was inseparable from the workhouse and the gruel, and that frightened people. For the first 6 months after Oliver Twist was removed, the system was in full operation. It was rather expensive at first, in consequence of the increase in the undertaker's bill, and the necessity of taking in the clothes of all the paupers, which fluttered loosely on their wasted, shrunken forms, after a week or two's gruel. But the number of workhouse inmates got thin as well as the paupers, and the board were in ecstasies. The room in which the boys were fed was a large stone hall, with a copper at one end, out of which the master, dressed in an apron for the purpose, and assisted by one or two women, ladled the gruel at meal times. Of this festive composition each boy had one porringer, and no more except on occasions of great public rejoicing, when he had 2 ounces and a quarter of bread besides. The bowls never wanted washing. The boys polished them with their spoons till they shone again, and when they had performed this operation, which never took very long, the spoons being nearly as large as the bowls, they would sit staring at the copper, with such eager eyes, as if they could have devoured the very bricks of which it was composed, employing themselves, meanwhile, in sucking their fingers most assiduously, with the view of catching up any stray splashes of gruel that might have been cast thereon. Boys have generally excellent appetites. Oliver Twist and his companions suffered the tortures of slow starvation for 3 months. At last they got so voracious and wild with hunger that one boy, who was tall for his age, and hadn't been used to that sort of thing, for his father had kept a small cook shop, hinted darkly to his companions that unless he had another basin of gruel per diem, he was afraid he might some night happen to eat the boy who slept next him, who happened to be a weakly youth of tender age. He had a wild, hungry eye, and they implicitly believed him. A council was held. Lots were cast who should walk up to the master after supper that evening, and ask for more, and it fell to Oliver Twist. The evening arrived. The boys took their places. The master, in his cook's uniform, stationed himself at the copper. His pauper assistants ranged themselves behind him. The gruel was served out, and a long grace was said over the short commons. The gruel disappeared. The boys whispered each other, and winked at Oliver, while his next neighbors nudged him. Child as he was desperate with hunger, and reckless with misery. He rose from the table, and advancing to the master, basin, and spoon in hand, said, somewhat alarmed at his own temerity, please, sir, I want some more. Apostrophe, the master was a fat, healthy man. But he turned very pale. He gazed in stupefied astonishment on the small rebel for some seconds, and then clung for support to the copper. The assistants were paralyzed with wonder, the boys with fear. What? ? Said the master at length, in a faint voice. Please, sir, replied Oliver, I want some more. The master aimed a blow at Oliver's head with the ladle, pinioned him in his arm, and shrieked aloud for the beadle. The board were sitting in solemn conclave, when Mr. Bumble rushed into the room in great excitement, and addressing the gentleman in the high chair, said, Mr. Limbkins, I beg your pardon, sir. Oliver Twist has asked for more. There was a general start. Horror was depicted on every countenance. For more. Said Mr. Limbkins. Compose yourself, Bumble, and answer me distinctly. Do I understand that he asked for more after he had eaten the supper allotted by the dietary? He did, sir, replied Bumble. That boy will be hung, said the gentleman in the white waistcoat. I know that boy will be hung. Nobody controverted the prophetic gentleman's opinion. An animated discussion took place. Oliver was ordered into instant confinement, and a bill was next morning pasted on the outside of the gate, offering a reward of £5 to anybody who would take Oliver Twist off the hands of the parish. In other words, £5 and Oliver Twist were offered to any man or woman who wanted an apprentice to any trade, business, or calling. I never was more convinced of anything in my life, said the gentleman in the white waistcoat, as he knocked at the gate, and read the bill next morning. I never was more convinced of anything in my life, than I am that that boy will come to be hung. As I purpose, to show in the sequel, whether the white waistcoated gentleman was right or not, I should perhaps mar the interest of this narrative, supposing it to possess any at all, if I ventured to hint just yet, whether the life of Oliver Twist had this violent termination or no. Gutenberg Edition. End of chapter.